From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today we bring you a report from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. I guess we'll start this week in Venezuela. Well, you know what? First of all, I think we had mentioned last week after we finished the report that maybe it's time now for a coming out and we can put somebody to rest in a warm, comfortable grave and...
let's put Tony to rest.
We can take off the mask. When we first started working together, I'm guessing, we never really probed it, but you had some contractual obligations or something that you couldn't do the radio work in your own name, and so Tony Solo came forth and volunteered to do the work for you. And now, however, we can tell the world you're actually the journalist Stephen Sefton that people have known and been following for many years.
Tony was a pseudonym that I used for many years because I was involved in community projects here to begin with under a non-Sandinista administration in Nicaragua.
Right.
And it wasn't a good idea to mix my community work at that time with my political opinions. I was working as I was writing articles in quite a few outlets. And so Tony was born, and now it's very definitely time for him to, if not kind of get laid to rest, at least take his retirement.
Maybe we could send him to Havana for a vacation or something.
Oh yeah, that would be great. He'd love that.
And see, if he drinks, it doesn't hurt your liver, so it's...
Right, exactly.
So, all right, well, that's good. So, Stephen, I get to actually not worry about slipping up and saying your name on the air from now on. And and if we invoke Tony once in a while out of habit and or respect, that's what it is, out of respect. Let's go to Venezuela.
Yeah, so the thing about Venezuela, there are some quite optimistic signs appearing in Venezuela in terms of its economy and the reactivation of the oil industry, the rise in the oil price, and with prospects for an increasing price over the next 3-4 months, maybe, especially as the world economy may begin to reactivate after last year. But that's very good news for Venezuela. One of the things that has been happening over the last week, that Alberto Fernandez, the Argentinian president, has been visiting Mexico, and he had a very high profile meeting with Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the Mexican president, and they're openly talking about saying that they need to be capable of tracing a new axis for Latin America and the Caribbean. And that's tremendously significant, yes, given the current context, because what they're essentially saying is, now both our governments have left the right-wing Lima group, we're going to do something else. And that probably means reactivating CELAC, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, which is tremendously important in terms of the ability of Latin America and the Caribbean to operate as a bloc, especially in their relations with China. Also, one of the things that came out last week was that Venezuela is in the process of negotiating the possibility of exporting its gas to Mexico, which is very much a slap in the face for the US and its genocidal sanction regime against both Venezuela and Cuba.
Right. You know, it's interesting too, by the way, when you talk about, you know, suddenly Mexico is coming into the fold with, you know, those states in the region that are, you know, looking to work outside of the, you know, the Western hegemon model. With Venezuela and then, you know, elsewhere, Iran and others,
suddenly, if Mexico joins that too, it's another, you know, oil-producing state, and just in general, the possibility of going outside of the petrodollar like grows immensely by throwing Mexico into the mix, into the fold, and that's one of the, you know, major building blocks of the architecture of the current, you know, situation. International construct. And so, you know, that's something that went away, I thought, back when Unasur was rising. They were talking about doing the UNO currency, and that seemed to go away as some of the states flipped sides. Now, suddenly, some of these projects, revitalizing CELAC, and you're bringing Mexico into the fold, who knows what could happen?
Right. Yeah, no, and the point about Mexico and Argentina is that they're both very, very important economies in Latin America, and they both have very serious commitments in terms of U.S. investment, and I think I mentioned to you in another program that around 25% of Argentina's economy is actually owned by U.S. investors. So, and it's not that you're talking about a Venezuela-style kind of rebellion against U.S. leadership. What they're saying is, we are very important in independent Latin American countries. We have our own interests, and while we recognize our relationship with the United States, we're determined not to allow the United States to dictate, in particular, our foreign policy agenda.
Right.
And that seems to me essentially what López Obrador and Fernández are saying.
Yeah, well, see, that opens up a lot of space, too.
That's very important in the because they're both, Mexico more so than Argentina, they're both very supportive of Venezuela.
Right.
Especially in a context where the Lima group is now kind of receding from the continental scene. I haven't seen any pronouncements from the Lima group for a couple of months now. So it'll be that's important to follow that and to see how that new proposed axis of especially in the diplomatic arena between Mexico and Argentina is going to work out. In relation to Venezuela, the other thing that's very important that has happened this week is that the European Union has apparently introduced some more sanctions against Venezuelan government functionaries. And the response of the Venezuelan government has been to expel the EU ambassador. And it seems to me that that's part of a global context where you have, as you mentioned before we started this conversation, we have a global context in which Russia has reached the end of its tether with both the European Union and the United States, and has been even somebody who's a superlative diplomat like Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, is being very outspoken about the gross failings in terms of respect for international law of both the European Union and the United States.
Right.
And you have that coupled as well with Iran's insistence that they're not going to be the ones that makes the first move in terms of reintegrating the United States into the nuclear agreement that had been reached prior to President Trump's presidency and from which he withdrew. So you have Russia being much more outspoken about the failings of the European Union and the United States in terms of their international obligations respecting international law. You've got Iran saying that they've done everything by the book and they're not going to make any more concessions to the United States as regards their nuclear program. And now you have Venezuela expelling the European Union ambassador in response to EU sanctions against Venezuela at a time when Venezuela is actually beginning to see its way out of beginning to re-energize, reanimate its moribund oil industry, thanks in large part to technical support from Iran, investment from China, and support from Russia. So, almost irrelevant and certainly counterproductive for the European Union to be imposing sanctions on individual Venezuelan functionaries, especially after the UN Special Rapporteur on Venezuela and the effect of the sanctions, the illegal unilateral measures from the United States in particular, but also from the European Union, the effects of those illegal measures on Venezuela's economy in human rights terms. And her report was totally damning, which was a great surprise to me. I never expected anybody from the UN to actually produce a truthful report about Venezuela.
Yeah, I was surprised.
But they did. Her report is totally damning about the United States and its total abdication of respect for international law. It's abuse of all kinds of international norms governing relations between countries, and it's outright violation of its obligations as a member of the United Nations.
Of course.
And that's also true, of course, of Europe.
Yep.
And individual European countries that have been looting Venezuela's wealth.
Yep.
For example, the British hanging on to Venezuela's gold, various European financial institutions freezing billions of dollars of Venezuela's funds.
Yep.
And all of that is completely illegal. So in that context, I think it'll be interesting to see how the European Union responds to that. I think we can agree with Sergei Lavrov and his colleagues, his Russian colleagues, that there's no point holding your breath waiting for the European Union or the United States to return to what is recognizable as acceptable diplomatic behavior and trade relations in practically every aspect of international relations. So that was interesting. It'll be interesting to follow. And that meeting, it'll be interesting to see what the follow-up is to that meeting between the Mexican and Argentinian presidents. And then, of course, one of the other big stories here in Latin America over the last month has been the developments in relation to Ecuador's presidential elections. There was some uncertainty in the immediate aftermath of the elections, because although Andrés Arauz, the candidate who's very much associated with the policies of former President Rafael Correa, although he very clearly won the ballot on the first round of voting with something close to 33% of the vote, the second place was tied between the right-wing banker Guillermo Lasso, who's notoriously corrupt, this guy Perez, the indigenous people's leader, very closely associated with the Pachakutik party, they were tied on around 19.5% of the vote. And finally, the Ecuadorian Electoral Council decided that Lasso had the advantage by a tiny margin of something like 0.64%.
The difference. They're showing right now 19.74 to 19.38.
Right, so 36%, 0.36.
Yeah, right.
Percent.
Yeah.
And of course, Perez is very much contesting that. And he's organized a march of his indigenous people supporters to Quito, to the installations of the National Electoral Authority there. And it remains to be seen what's going to happen as a result of that. Mm. But in formal terms, Lasso is going to go into the second round runoff against Andres Arauz.
Right.
And it's just not clear to me, and you may have better information than me, whether Arauz has a real advantage. Because, do you remember we were talking the last time about the fact that the fourth place candidate, a guy called Hervé, Javier Hervé, representing some kind of supposedly left-wing progressive force.
Right.
He got about 15% of the vote.
Yes, I'm 15.68 here, yeah.
Right, so but what he's doing is, while saying that he actually rejects the neoliberal policies of Guillermo Lasso, up until about 2 weeks ago, he was still calling for a united front to keep out Andres Arauz.
Yeah, this is Trotsky nonsense, you know, whatever. Right. Somebody, I don't know, if it weren't such odd times right now, one might make a joke about ice picks or something, but I guess you can't in the current climate. But that's Trotsky. It is, we're the pure socialist alternative. The first thing we have to do is kill all the other socialists. So the ones that are out in front right now, let's get rid of them. Let's let the Nazis have power while we build a real socialist party, and then we'll come back and bring socialist heaven forever. That's more or less their nonsense.
Yeah, and what I gleaned from reading around stuff to do with the election and the campaign is that this guy Hervé very much exploited the youth vote. And it's possible that he may have convinced those people who voted for him temporarily, but it seems to me that if he turned around and then said, right, let's all vote, let's unite with the extreme right wing who've been making our lives misery for the last 4 years, and let's unite with them to keep out Arauz, that's not a convincing political position given him the constituency that apparently voted for him.
Right. That's right. Well,
so I think that Arauz will win. I think it's going to be very close. Do you remember how close it was back in 2016 when Lenin Moreno won on the second round? He didn't win by very much. And I think it's going to be quite similar this time around.
Yeah,
I think Arauz is likely to win, but not by much.
It was 51.16 to 48.84. Lasso
I missed that.
It was Lasso had 48.84 last time to Lenny Moreno's 51.16.
Right. So, what are you talking about? 2.5%.
Yeah,
something
that. Yeah,
2.7%.
Yeah.
Which isn't great.
Right.
I think Lasso is likely to do better than we might expect, because Perez's supporters, they may well abstain, because he's very clear that he doesn't want anything to do with Arauz.
Not really.
But who knows? We'll just have to see. And I think it's likely that Arauz will just win it. But the thing is that even if he wins, the other political parties have a majority in the National Assembly. Even if Arauz does win the presidency, he's going to have a difficult time getting his legislative agenda through.
Right.
Because the opposition parties will control the National Assembly. He has a very strong block of votes, but he's going to be constantly looking for alliances in order to be able to get his legislative agenda through the National Assembly.
You know, that's not the most unhealthy situation for politicians to face, by the way.
You know, it may be frustrating, and it may even be naive to state it this way, because you're considering that there are some people, in fact, who are absolutely evil, period. And they're part of now what you have to incorporate into a coalition. But having a check on one's own power inside of government can be healthy too, in terms of both in terms of governing, but also in terms of building support, broader support out in the world. You know?
Very much so, Don. Because, and I don't know if you remember from our conversations from many years ago, but what happened in Nicaragua was that in the first term of Daniel Ortega's return to the presidency in January 2007, between 2007-2011, he didn't have a majority.
Right, I remember.
In the National Assembly.
I remember.
But what happened was that people could see that the opposition parties were trying to prevent the government implementing a program that was beneficial to the great majority of people. And what that led to was a landslide win in 2011.
That's right.
On the basis of which the Sandinista government under President Ortega was able to implement their program and make huge advances in a very short period of time, up until the failed coup attempt in 2018.
Yep. Yeah. I mean,
so maybe something happened. Maybe that dynamic will also happen in Ecuador, assuming that Arauz does win on the second round.
I mean, these things do evolve, of course. You know, that's the nature of them. So the relationships between the parties, the relationships between the classes and interests that they represent, the skill set and also the personal and other relationships among the members, party relationships or whatever, political relationships, all these things are in flux all the time. It's like, you know, sort of like riding a sailboat through a storm or something, in a way. You have to manage it actively, but it's not that's the condition, and there are definitely some benefits that you can get from managing that kind of a situation properly.
Yeah, and if Arauz is able to negotiate his way through all those difficulties over the next 4 years, assuming he wins on the second round, and it'll be a great political education for the general population.
I agree with that completely.
And that's certainly what happened in Nicaragua between 2007-2011.
Yeah, Nicaragua. Why don't we talk about that? We've got about, hang on, what do we got, about 9 minutes left or something? I got 19. We got about 6 minutes left. You are now a Nicaraguan, officially. Why don't we talk about that, your journey to that point a little bit, what motivated it, and what it meant, and the process you had to go through?
Well, the process, going through the process is very simple. You just have to fulfill a certain set of prerequisites and satisfy the authorities that you're in good faith in your application, and that's enough to allow you the privilege of receiving Nicaraguan citizenship. And I was lucky enough to be able to complete that process. And for me, it was a very big deal. It was a very important moment in my life, because, and I think in many ways, Nicaragua, and if you look at Nicaragua in mainstream terms, and it's regarded as practically completely irrelevant as a country and as a government and as a society. But from my point of view, it is the most completely relevant country, certainly in the Western Hemisphere, that in terms of how do you bring socialist policies to an impoverished majority that has historically been excluded and repressed. And every time that population rises up and shows that it what it's capable of in terms of forging its own destiny, the United States and its European Union partners crush it. And they just never give up. They won't lie down. They won't bow their heads and say yes, sir. And that's a tremendously attractive characteristic for somebody who's of strong socialist beliefs. In fact, I'm in some ways I'm very much a coward. I just find it impossible to try and live in my own country, Ireland, or in the United Kingdom, where I was born. Because those societies, that, as far as I can see, have gone completely insane. And so, for me, living in Nicaragua over the last 25, 30 years has been kind of a rebirth. And I'm in a country where it's perfectly normal to see speeches by Fidel Castro and Nicolas Maduro and Hugo Chavez.
Right.
And it's, you know, and people will watch them and listen to them and take them seriously. And I'm in a country that regards Cuba and the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela as sister and brother nations,
yep.
Whose systems are worthy of emulation and analysis and serious consideration. They're not just written off as, oh, that Cuban dictatorship, or
right.
Oh, that dictator Nicolas Maduro, you know, which is just—it's just insane. That's insanity.
Yes, it is.
And that is what characterizes the media output of North America and Western Europe. So living in Nicaragua, I'm free of that insanity.
Yeah.
You know, and so. For me, after living here for 25 years and dedicating my life to working on education projects and health projects with people at grassroots, and being allowed the privilege of receiving Nicaraguan citizenship is a tremendous honor for me and something I'm very proud of.
Well, congratulations. It's interesting. I'm looking at some of the law of Nicaraguan citizenship. And one thing that's interesting is for its native people, for people that are native-born Nicaraguans, they cannot lose their citizenship. It's like, it's a birthright the way they treat it. So,
right.
You could lose yours if you went somewhere else and acquired citizenship, but you could come back and reacquire yours. Also, any minor children you have at the moment... are also now Nicaraguan citizens by naturalization. There's some very interesting elasticity, some real human characteristics to some of the legal, framework there for it. It's different from most countries.
And also Nicaraguan citizens, there's an agreement called the C4 agreement, whereby people from Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua
right.
can move between all of those countries and just show. Here, I don't know what it's like in the States, but here everybody has to have an identity card.
Right.
But you don't. In order for me to travel to any of the other Central American countries except Costa Rica, I just have to show my Nicaraguan ID.
Yep. So that worked. That was an interesting thing.
That's interesting too, and it's indicative of Nicaragua's commitment to Central American integration.
Exactly. The entire project in that region. You see so many things like. Well, congratulations. We're out of time, and. I'd like to discuss this at some point in some considerable depth because your experience there, you've been there for decades now doing work, and you say in education, some of the education being digging foundations for school buildings and things like that.
Right.
And so we'll pick it up next week, and thank you for your time. Stephen Sefton, welcome to CPR, and Tony Solo, buenas noches.
Yeah, all right, hey, Tony.
Right, thanks a lot. Take care,
Stephen.
He wasn't
a bad guy.
All right, man. Be well. Thank you, Stephen.
Yeah, thanks a million, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.